Arnold, NPR News.
World Health officials are warning that more than 2 million people could become infected with a form of tuberculosis between this year and 2015 that's resistant to many drug treatments. Today, the WHO's top official on the matter told reporters in Geneva that too many countries are failing to conduct proper surveillance or treatment. But Eastern Europe was singled out as a success story in its reduction of infection rates with aggressive treatment programs. Here's the latest from Wall Street. Dow Jones Industrial Average down 6 points to 12,010. NASDAQ Composite Index down 6 points at 2,678. S&P 500 also down 5 at 1,289. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org.
You'll find thousands of used albums, plus CDs, videotapes, DVDs, and working stereo equipment at the 2011 Vintage Vinyl Sale, held on April 30th. We'll be at the new site, the former Altman's Billiard and Barstool Supply, located at 301 West Market View Drive in Champaign. Proceeds benefit the Illinois Radio Reader.
Dan Savage started the It Gets Better project in response to reports about bullied gay teenagers committing suicide.
If there are 14 and 15 and 16-year-olds, 13-year-olds, 12-year-olds out there watching this video, what I'd love you to take away from it really is that it gets better.
On the next Fresh Air, Dan Savage and his partner Terry Miller join us.
Today at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. It's hour two of the show. I'm David Inge. Harriet Williamson is our producer. The following program comes from the Focus archive, so that means that for the next hour, we will not be taking your calls.
The civil rights movement has often been presented as a struggle between black and white men. Historian Danielle McGuire says that the movement is also rooted in the long struggle of African-American women against sexual violence. It's a story that she tells in her recent book, At the Dark End of the Street. This book looks at the sexualized violence that marked racial politics and African-American lives during the modern civil rights movement, something that she argues that has often been overlooked by civil rights historians. Danielle McGuire is assistant professor in the history department at Wayne State University in Detroit. Her book, At the Dark End of the Street, the subtitle Black Women, Rape, and Resistance, A New History of the Civil Rights Movement from Rosa Parks to the Rise of Black Power. It's recently been published. It's published by Knopf. It's out now if you'd like to look at the book. And Professor McGuire, hello.
Hello, good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. Well, I'm struggling with a little cold. Other than that, I guess I'm okay.
Good.
I appreciate you being with us this morning, and particularly because I think this is a very interesting story, and one that really you make the argument that this is this particular aspect, the ways in which these concerns about sexual violence directed by white men against black women, was something that really helped to shape, to energize the civil rights struggle, and it's something that. Certainly I was not aware of, and I'm sure that a lot of people really would not have been aware of.
Yeah, you know, it's something that even I wasn't aware of as I was studying the civil rights movement, both as an undergraduate and then as a graduate student. And it's not something that we read about in most of the civil rights histories. So I was struck by the frequency of these stories in black newspapers when I was looking at them, you know, newspapers from the 1940s, the 1950s. And couldn't believe that these stories, which were on the front pages of most black newspapers around the country, weren't in the history books. And the more I started to look at the stories, the more I realized that this was very common, that it was something that had continued, that was sort of a leftover, if you will, from slavery, and that black women fought back. Black women testified about what happened to them. They told their preachers, their husbands. They told the NAACP. They wrote letters to the Justice Department. And their testimonies often led to campaigns for civil rights. And I think that's what was most shocking to me, that these weren't campaigns that were isolated or just limited to sexual violence or what happened to black women, but that their stories helped to spark larger movements for human dignity.
Yeah. Well, your book starts out with a story of a woman named Recy Taylor. Tell us about Recy Taylor and her experience.
Recy Taylor was a black woman in 1944, and she was walking home from a church revival in September. It was the fall. She was with some friends, and a car full of white men kidnapped her off the street, drove her to the woods, and gang-raped her at gunpoint. When they finished, they dropped her off in the middle of town, and they told her that if she said anything to anybody, they would kill her. This was a real threat in 1944. You know, it's serious. But she went home. She found the courage to tell her husband, her father, and the local sheriff, a white man. And within a few days, the Montgomery branch of the NAACP found out what had happened to her. And they called, and they said they were sending their very best detective. And that was Rosa Parks.
Mm-hmm.
It was 11 years before the Montgomery bus boycott. So Rosa Parks goes to Abbeville. She interviews Recy Taylor. She takes down the details of the assault. And hears Taylor's testimony, and then takes the story back to Montgomery, where she and the most militant activists in the city, people like Edie Nixon and Johnny Carr and Solomon Say Sr., who was a minister, they launch a campaign that the Chicago Defender, a black newspaper out of Chicago, called the strongest campaign for equal justice to be seen in a decade. They compared it in scope to the Scottsboro case. I mean, it was a nationwide effort to get justice for Recy Taylor, and Rosa Parks helped to lead it. So this is just a shocking and interesting story about not only Rosa Parks, but about a black woman's testimony leading to a national campaign for human rights.
Yeah, and there's another story that you tell in here, and I think actually this was the story that you explained got you interested in this in the first place. It was a story of another assault on a woman named Gertrude Perkins, who lived in Montgomery. She was also actually abducted and assaulted by two white Montgomery police officers. This was a couple of years, I think 5 years later, and this was something that really galvanized the black community in Montgomery.
Right. I mean, it's just a fascinating sort of piece of the puzzle that I don't think a lot of historians had put together. You know, we often think of the Montgomery bus boycott as beginning with Rosa Parks' refusal to get up out of her seat in December of 1955. But I was listening to NPR one day, and they were talking to veterans of the Montgomery bus boycott, and Joe Asbell, who is the editor of the Montgomery Advertiser, said something like, Gertrude Perkins is never mentioned in the history books, but she had as much to do with the bus boycott as anyone on earth. And he said it, you know, with such certitude. And I thought, who on earth is Gertrude Perkins? She's not in any history books. And so I was, you know, pretty astounded that he'd say something like that. So I went and checked out the Montgomery Advertiser archives, you know, the microfilm, and I paged through the microfilm and found this story from 1949, like you said. Two white Montgomery police officers picked her up as she was walking home from a party, and they drove her outside of town, and they raped her in uniform, and then took her back home. She went to see her minister, and that was Reverend Solomon Say Sr., and then he wrote a story to Drew Pearson. He wrote a letter to Drew Pearson, and Drew Pearson was a syndicated columnist who had a radio show. And the next morning, Drew Pearson put the story on his radio show. So when Montgomery City officials woke up, there was a story on the airwaves of a black woman accusing white police officers of assault, and it sort of shook the city to its core. It also helped mobilize the black community. The ministers typically had been, you know, I think, argumentative amongst themselves and hadn't really come together en masse for a big movement, with the exception of a handful of them. And this really shook them up and brought them all together to, you know, launch a campaign to defend Gertrude Perkins' womanhood.
Yeah.
So it was fascinating. Yeah, I didn't know what it meant. You know, I didn't know that this was connected to the bus boycott or how it was connected for a long time. It took me a long time to put the puzzle pieces together, but eventually I did.
Yeah, I like that story very much because it involves National Public Radio.
Right.
Yeah.
It shows that you can learn a lot when you listen to NPR.
Yeah, that's right. Our guest is Danielle McGuire. She is assistant professor of history at Wayne State University. That's in Detroit. And she's the author of a recently published book, At the Dark End of the Street, Black Women, Rape, and Resistance, A New History of the Civil Rights Movement, From Rosa Parks to the Rise of Black Power. It's published by Knopf. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And just sort of to take a step back, the thing that I think is good about this is it helps to give greater depth to the kind of portrait, the kind of picture in their minds that I think a lot of people will have of Rosa Parks. Because I think that probably everybody's heard the story. Yes, Rosa Parks, you know, she was riding the bus home after a long day of work. She was tired. The bus driver came along and said, "You have to give up your seat to these white people who are standing." And she said, "No, I'm not going to do that." And of course, that she gets the credit for touching off what eventually became the bus boycott, which was a very important early event in the civil rights movement. Well, that's sort of the way that it happened, but it doesn't, people don't really, I think, appreciate, maybe scholars do, but don't really appreciate the fact that she had been involved in civil rights work for a long time before this, going back, as you said, back to the mid-40s, when she was working with the NAACP.
Right, it goes back even further. I mean, she and her husband were active in defending the Scottsboro Boys, you know, the nine African-American young men who were convicted of assaulting two white women on a freight train near Scottsboro, Alabama in 1931. So Rosa Parks and her husband Raymond were fundraisers and defenders of the Scottsboro Boys. They held secret meetings in Montgomery, you know, at night. In the 1930s, during the dark days of the Depression. And Rosa Parks recalls in one of her memoirs that, you know, she would sort of wait outside while the men were inside planning the meetings. And she said she'd never seen so few men with so many guns. Hmm. So, I mean, this is fascinating. Like, you don't think of Rosa Parks as somebody who would advocate armed self-defense, but she certainly was. And, you know, that's in the 1930s. So she had a long career. She joined the NAACP in 1943 after she had had a number of run-ins with this particular bus driver who happened to be the same bus driver that, you know, ordered her out of the seat in 1955. She was the leader of the NAACP Youth Council, so she was training young people how to organize and how to resist the Jim Crow structure. And she worked for Edie Nixon as secretary of the Brotherhood, the Alabama branch of the Brotherhood of the Sleeping Car Porters, one of the largest black unions in the country, certainly the most militant black union in the country. So she was surrounded by, you know, radicals, really, activists who were fierce and who were opposed to the status quo. She was not this, you know, simple seamstress who had foot fatigue. You know, I think most stories in our history books and popular perceptions of Rosa Parks is that her feet were so tired that she couldn't stand, and then, you know, the walls of segregation came tumbling down. But it's so much more interesting than that.
Yeah. Apparently, in the way that this, what we're talking about here, the sexual harassment and sexual assault against black women, the way that that connects to the buses is that you talk about how it's certainly the case that women were assaulted in, for example, in white homes where they worked, but there also were assaults in public places like theaters and buses. Apparently, bus drivers were implicated in a lot of sexual harassment of black women.
That's right. I mean, buses were in many ways the bane of a black woman's day. You know, most of the riders in Montgomery were black women. They were mostly domestics who had to ride from the black side of town to the white side of town where they would work in white homes throughout the day doing, you know, white people's chores. So getting on the bus was often a humiliating experience. Bus drivers would slap them, would touch them inappropriately. They would make nasty sexualized insults and comments about women. One woman said that bus drivers like to, quote, talk under folks' clothes. Which is an old-time way of saying, you know, they're looking right through my clothes and talking about my body parts and, you know, looking at them like sexual objects. But also, you know, black women were just abused on the buses. They would, they resented the fact that they had to pay up front and then had to walk to the back in order to enter the bus, you know, lest their bodies touch white bodies on the way down the aisle to the colored section of the bus. And oftentimes, bus drivers, before black women could get on in the rear, they'd shut the doors. And there were numerous cases in which black women's feet or coats were caught in the doors, and then they were dragged by the buses. There are some cases, in fact, in which some African-Americans were killed by this practice. So the bus ride every day was a humiliating, awful experience, and black women were really fed up with it, especially by the early 1950s. There had been other women before Parks who refused to get out of a seat so that a white person could sit, and Joanne Robinson, who was head of the Women's Political Council, had threatened a boycott starting in 1953. So, again, you know, Rosa Parks' stand on the bus that day in 1955 had a lot of historical precedence.
Yeah. There, and as you say, the cases like the cases of Gertrude Perkins and Recy Taylor were not uncommon. There apparently was a case that involved an assault by a man who was a white man who owned a grocery store, and that led to a boycott of that man's store, and that apparently helped to establish the idea of boycott as a tactic?
That's right. I mean, there were boycotts on streetcars in Montgomery in the early 20th century, you know, the first part of the 20th century, and like there were in New Orleans and other cities throughout the country. So there is a precedent for boycotting public transportation. But in the 1950s, you know, after Brown and after the brutality, you know, post-World War II, I think African Americans were very fearful. And this boycott on Sam Green's grocery store — Sam Green was a white man who owned a grocery store in the black community. Almost all of his customers were African American, and so that's how he made his living. He employed a young black girl as a babysitter frequently, and one night, you know, on his way home, he was driving her home to her parents' house. He pulled along a quiet road and then raped her. She told her parents, and her parents called Rufus Lewis, who was a celebrated football coach at Alabama State and who was head of Voters League in Montgomery, and who was, you know, good friends with Edie Nixon, who was good friends with Rosa Parks. And they, you know, organized a campaign to try to bring Sam Green to justice. When he was acquitted of this crime, which was all too common for white men in the South who attacked black women, African Americans decided to render their own verdict, and they boycotted a store, and they shut it down. So it established the boycott as a really effective tool to get justice when the system that was in place refused it.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, that the as far as the buses were concerned, a lot of the patrons of the bus system were black women who worked as domestics who had to ride the bus to get to work. And the boycott was successful, and even though it was maybe difficult for them because then they ended up having to walk, but it was successful because it was such a bad experience for black women to ride the buses that it was almost easier just to stop riding the buses. And because of that, and the fact that the black women were willing to walk to where they had to get to go, those things really contributed to the success of the boycott.
That's right. It's incredible. I mean, you know, people often wonder how change happens and how we make change. And the Montgomery bus boycott is a perfect example of looking at the power of ordinary people to do something on a day-to-day basis, or in this case, to refuse to do something on a day-to-day basis. I mean, a boycott is a passive activity, right? You just avoid the buses. You don't have to put your body on the line in order to protest something. You just remove yourself from the thing that is causing so much pain and so much degradation. So it's a really effective passive weapon, a nonviolent weapon. And it was the right thing to do at the right moment because things were so violent in the 1950s because of the Brown decision ordering desegregation of schools. Whites were in a tizzy. They were really angered and upset that the Supreme Court would order integration. And there were a handful of whites who caused serious damage through violence towards blacks who were promoting integration, right? So removing yourself from the buses was actually a really safe thing to do, but it proved to be ultimately very effective in destroying Jim Crow in Montgomery. And the reason why it happened is because black women refused to get on the buses every morning. And they could do this because they built an impossible-to-imagine carpool system that ferried black women wherever they needed to go throughout the day, whether it was to work or to the grocery store or to visit family. I mean, they had over, 300 or 400 cars in operation taking people to and from the places they need to go, which is just incredible.
Our guest, again, let me introduce, is Danielle McGuire. She's an historian. She's assistant professor in the history department at Wayne State University. That's in Detroit. And tells this story in a book that she's written. It's just recently come out, At the Dark End of the Street is the title. Knopf is the publisher. About the significance of sexual assault against black women by white men and how that was something that really served as a point around which people organized as part of the civil rights movement. And it's something that she really makes the argument that a lot of the history that's been written about the movement hasn't really taken this fully into account. If you'd like to call in, 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And you can email us at well-talk@illinois.edu. So we're talking here a little specifically about Montgomery, about one community, and about how women's anger, the whole community's anger, really, black community's anger about this was something that really gave people something to organize around. There were other places as well, though, other towns where assaults against black women was a point that people focused on and organized around?
Absolutely. I mean, this is what I think is so shocking about this history, and the thing that I was really struck by as I did this research is that major campaigns that we think we know about, like Montgomery, Selma, Birmingham, movements in Tallahassee, in North Carolina, almost all of them in Mississippi, the Freedom Summer, for example, in 1964, we often think of those things as starting because of voting rights or desire to integrate public accommodations or schools. But so often I found that one of the precipitating factors in organizing these campaigns was assault against black women. And these kinds of things happened to African-American women throughout the South, across time and place, you know, mostly in the 1940s and early 1950s, but throughout the 60s and early 1970s as well. And I think what's so fascinating is that for as much as we talk about women being silent about sexual violence, particularly before the women's movement, here are examples of black women using their voices as weapons of protest, testifying openly and publicly about these assaults in order to get some justice. And their testimonies are what helped to launch campaigns. So we see the same thing happening in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, in Selma, Alabama, in Tallahassee, Florida, in Raleigh, North Carolina. I mean, it's really incredible, all the different places that this happens, and all the different places in which testimonies spark movements and campaigns, not just for black women's defense of black womanhood, but for basic civil rights and human dignity.
We have a caller to talk with in Urbana, here where we are. Let's do that. Our line number one. Hello?
Yes. This is very interesting. I wonder if this author would talk about the degree to which the Highlander School in Newmarket, Tennessee, was consciously addressing the issue of the sexual abuse of black women. Rosa Parks was there and played a role in that school. Thank you. I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. Can you do that?
Sure. You know, I'm not sure about the Highlander School's role in organizing to defend black women from sexual violence, but I do know that the Highlander School was an island, you know, an interracial island in a sea of racial hostility. It was a place where black and white activists could go and safely learn how to organize their own communities. And Rosa Parks went to the Highlander School in the summer before the bus boycott, so in the summer of 1955. She was there learning how to organize, learning how to make change to the Jim Crow system. She was there with black activists and white activists alike. And at first she was very reluctant to go. She didn't want to go and, you know, be in an integrated environment because she didn't have good experiences with white people. But she went, and she talks about in one of her memoirs of being free and feeling this sort of sense of freedom that she couldn't feel anywhere else, and feeling a sense of comfort and humanity at Highlander that she really didn't get an opportunity to feel many other places, except, you know, exclusively within the black community. So the Highlander is really important because it's a place for training activists. It still is to this day. It's a wonderful place. And it was very important to the roots of the civil rights movement. Very, very, very important. But I'm just not sure. You know, I just haven't done the research to know whether or not they were involved in organizing to defend black women from sexual violence.
Other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You can also email us at well-talk@illinois.edu. Something I think it's probably important to place this in a kind of a context and just make the point that going back to slavery, that slave owners used their slaves sexually, they could do it with impunity. They could do it because they did it because they could, and that though that was something that carried over after slavery as a means of control,
right,
of black people.
That's right. I mean, it's really kind of shocking because you see the roots of this in slavery. I mean, the slave system, the way that it was established, gave slave status to the children of black women. So, you know, the rules started early, you know, 1619. They changed the status of children from coming from the man, the father, to coming from the woman. And they did this really on purpose so that white men who fathered children with black women could reproduce more and more slaves. And so this gave them, you know, a financial incentive to assault black women in many ways, because if you could have more black children with black women, then you could increase your property value because slaves were considered property. But it also allowed white men to just, you know, abuse black women with impunity, and it enabled them in many ways to control the sexualities of black women and black men. And, you know, in order to keep property value and family inheritance clear and clean, they could control white women's sexuality as well, because white women were not allowed to sleep with anybody else, right? So this is a tool. Sexual violence and sex becomes a weapon and a tool used to maintain white supremacy, used to develop a foundation for white supremacy. And then when slavery falls, a lot of the practices that, you know, surrounded the sex and sexual violence with black women remained. So, you know, from slavery through the better part of the 20th century, you see a pattern of white men abducting and assaulting black women with impunity and with alarming regularity. The stories are the same again and again and again. And it's why I use the term ritualized, because it seems ritualistic, even though I have no smoking gun to say this was a ritual of white men, right? It seems ritualistic. The style and the stories and the ways of going about abusing black women are the same, as if the stories are and the practices are handed down from one generation to another. Mm.
And what's also, I think, particularly ironic is that the image of the black sexual predator, that is, of black men preying on white women, was something that was used to frighten whites and bolster segregation.
Right. I mean, basically what I think white supremacists did is they took their own practices and turned them on their head. They projected their own crimes and their own deviant behaviors onto black men and women in order to maintain their own power. So you see this myth, this idea of the black man as a rapist. Whenever African Americans assert themselves as human beings or demand citizenship rights granted by the Constitution, you see it during Reconstruction. You see it during World War One. A lot during World War One. You see it used during and after World War Two, when African American soldiers come back from overseas and assert their right as citizens, you know, and as veterans, and whites using the fear of black men as rapists to deny them those voting rights and those citizenship rights. And, you know, it's all rooted, I think, in white practices that are documentable, you know, that we have evidence for, of them raping black women.
In many of these cases, the black community at some risk came together and went to the white power structure demanding justice. For example, in the case of Gertrude Perkins, the one we talked to there in Montgomery, who was assaulted by two white police officers, she reported it to the police. Oh, they said this, she was just lying. There was a grand jury which failed to, not surprising, failed to indict the accused. How many other efforts were there, in fact, efforts to get people charged with these crimes?
There were endless efforts. I mean, it's really incredible looking at the evidence. There are a number of cases, in fact, throughout the South in the 1940s, and there are a number of convictions, which I think, you know, most people are shocked to find out as well. I mean, I think the assumption among most people who study this history is that there were never any white men convicted of raping black women for the crime of rape. But that's just not true. There were white men convicted. Most of the time they were not, right? They were failed, there was a failed indictment, or, you know, they were never even brought to trial. But there were cases in which white men were brought to trial, and there were cases in which they were convicted. Throughout the 1940s, the men who made it to trial and who were convicted got really paltry sentences, you know, a year, 2 years, maybe hard labor. But over time, as African Americans organized, you start to see their campaigns paying off, so that by 1959, in Tallahassee, Florida, four white men who gang-raped a black college student from Florida A&M University received life in prison. It's the first case I found in which white men received life for raping a black woman. And then by 1965, in Mississippi, you know, the most unreconstructed state in the South, a white man named Norman Cannon gets life in prison and actually serves life. I mean, you know, in 2002, he appealed his case from 1965, and he lost. So he was actually in prison for life for raping a black teenager in Hattiesburg in 1965. And then, of course, by 1974-75, Joanne Little, an African-American woman in Washington, North Carolina, is in prison. And a jailer attempts to assault her with an ice pick, sexually assault her with an ice pick. And she manages to wrestle the ice pick away from him and stabs him to death. And she ends up being acquitted for murder on the argument that black women had the right to self-defense. Mm-hmm. So you see a progression. I mean, there's progress that's been made over time, you know, where you go from white men who won't even be indicted, you know, where the authorities will laugh at the black woman bringing a case to them, all the way to the point where a black woman is actually allowed or gets away with killing her assailant as self-defense. But that's only because black women were willing to testify about these crimes and the black community was willing to stand behind them and demand protection for black womanhood.
Well, you also have to wonder what you talked about this 1959 case, the Tallahassee, Florida case, as being a major turning point at the point where at least that was maybe the one of the first times or first times you could see someone not only being convicted but also really getting a serious sentence,
right,
for the crime. And one wonders, well, what really made it possible for there to be that turning point?
It's a great question, and I've struggled to find out a good answer to that. In a lot of these cases, you know, trials turn on local politics and what's possible locally. So Tallahassee is unique in that there's a large black middle class. There's a black college, and the people who go to that college are, you know, they have money, they have access, they're educated, they have means to hire attorneys and to press cases and to get access to media. You know, they can make a public case out of something like this in a way that a black family in rural Mississippi might not be able to. It's 1959. The United States is at the beginning stages of the Cold War, and this becomes the kind of thing that you can use to highlight, you know, the lack of justice in America against, you know, in its global campaign to project itself as the greatest democracy on earth against the Soviet Union. So, you know, black leaders use those openings, those political openings, as weapons in order to get justice, you know, during these kinds of politically opportune times, like World War II, like the Cold War. And then locally, I think there were a number of white people who were appalled at the behavior of these four white men and believed they should serve time, partly because I think the white men are lower class. They're easily pigeonholed and scapegoated, and the white community can sort of wash their hands of this kind of disgusting crime by putting the men in jail, without acknowledging that this had happened very frequently and by men who were certainly of higher status, you know, economic status than these men were. So I think there's a lot of things that play into these convictions, local politics, you know, politics in general, you know, what's possible in the United States for, you know, national black organizations, how can they use the sort of status quo to their benefit, and then, you know, how does the white community view the crime as well? What's happening within the white community that would enable them to do that? Because you might see a similar case, for example, there's a similar case that summer in 1959 in North Carolina where a white Marine is sentenced to life in prison and actually then sentenced to the death penalty for rape. And on appeal, the jury overturns it and basically says he's not guilty. So it just, you know, it really just depends on the jury and the local politics and how big of a media case African-Americans can make it.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Danielle McGuire. She's an assistant professor in the history department at Wayne State University. That's in Detroit. And the book that we're talking about, if you'd like to read more, is titled At the Dark End of the Street, Black Women, Rape, and Resistance, A New History of the Civil Rights Movement, From Rosa Parks to the Rise of Black Power. And it's published by Knopf. It's just out recently. I mentioned back at the beginning when we started to talk that the book starts off with the story of this woman named Recy Taylor and her experience being a gang raped in 1944 by a group of white men. You actually met her and had a chance to talk with her.
I did. It was incredible. It was really exciting. I didn't know that she was alive. I had a really hard time finding her, in fact, because so often is the case with women where they get married and their names change. And Recy Taylor's name has changed three times since she was a Taylor. She's no longer a Taylor. She's not even, you know, her second marriage's last name. So her brother actually found me. And he had read something on the internet about the book, and he called me and he said, if you want to know the real story, give me a call. And I thought, oh boy, do I ever want to know the real story. So he introduced us, and I went to visit her in Abbeville, Alabama, in the same town where this happened, where the whole family still lives, and got to talk to her on the same day that Barack Obama was inaugurated as the first African-American president of the United States. And it was a really profound meeting, not only because here I am speaking to this woman who in 1944, before the women's movement, before the civil rights movement, had the courage to speak out not only against sexual violence but against racial brutality at great risk to her life and to her family's lives, but also because I think because it was that day that Obama was inaugurated, it marked the time in a way that showed real progress, right? I mean, I'm not saying that things are perfect or that we live in a post-racial society, which I don't believe we do, but I think that we have to acknowledge the gains of the movement and the progress that was made because people like Recy Taylor, ordinary, everyday people, put their lives in line in defense of justice, in defense of the Constitution. So it was incredible to meet her, and I was really shy at first and, you know, kept sort of tiptoeing around the story. I asked a whole bunch of questions about the family, and finally she just looked at me and she said, well, do you want to know what happened or not? And I said, yes, ma'am, I'm sorry. And so she told her story, and the whole family was a witness, and it was really incredible. I think one of the most shocking things about the meeting was the way that her story reverberated across generations. So some family members didn't know what happened to her. You know, her siblings knew, and maybe their children knew, but great-grandchildren didn't know, and nieces and nephews, for the most part, didn't know. And so, you know, there were probably 25 people in the living room when we were talking, all extended family members. And, you know, the younger generation was really angry. They were sad. They were angry. They didn't really know what to do with this story. And you could tell that the fact that she didn't get justice, the fact that her assailants were able to walk free, remains a kind of trauma for the whole family. You know, you can see the way this has affected people over time and continues to affect her. So I think it taught me that, you know, I like to think of these stories as being past. You know, that these are things that happened yesterday, a long time ago. It's over. But for this family, it's not over. And I don't think it will be over until there's some kind of justice for her.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have an email here from someone who is listening. Actually, they're in Austria. And they're listening on the internet. The person writes that they actually grew up near Urbana, followed the news rather closely when they were growing up in the 60s and 70s. And they're wondering if notable black leaders, people like Dr. King, publicly addressed this issue in speeches. And if they did it, did the news media, particularly the white news media, white-controlled news media, did they report on that? Did they suppress it?
That's a great question. King spoke out about the Tallahassee case, and it was brief, but he did it. And he tied it to other examples of injustice during that summer, particularly the lynching of a black man named Mac Charles Parker. He was lynched in Mississippi. Most often, the NAACP chose not to comment on what they called sex cases, mostly because they were a national organization that was working with members of Congress and the president to try to change the laws. And they were constantly afraid of being accused of being a communist organization or being a kind of organization that Congress couldn't do business with. So they were very conservative. I mean, people like to think of the NAACP as this radical liberal organization, but at the time, the NAACP was pretty conservative in the cases that it chose to affiliate itself with and the cases it championed. And in that sense, King was similar. And so were a lot of the black men of the time. I mean, don't forget that calling attention to crimes against black women calls attention as well to the fact that black men could not protect them. And so in many ways, you know, for black men to make a public, particularly in the 60s, especially after the movement as we know it really takes off, you know, after the Freedom Rides in 1961, and after Birmingham in 1963, you have what you can really call a movement, right, with a major leader and national organizations that are leading it. Those organizations chose, I think, specifically and deliberately to focus on voter registration and public accommodations because those were the things that they could really win in Congress. And if they started talking about sex and sexual violence, you know, in the 1950s or 1960s when it was impolitic to do so and could have called into question their, I don't know, their loyalty maybe to basic decency or standards, they would have, I think, lost a lot of political capital with Washington. Yeah. And so, you know, I'm not making excuses for them, but I just know that that's where they were coming from. And so they, in many ways, they left it up to local NAACP branches to fight it out. And they encouraged when victims wrote to the NAACP or other big organizations, they would write back and say, here's a local attorney you can go to. You need to try this, you know, in your county first. Take it up with your local NAACP chapter. So it was something the national NAACP was, I think, too silent about. You know, they spent a lot of time talking about the lynching of black men, but not enough time talking about what happened to black women. And I think that's a tragedy. At the same time, I understand their political motivations for doing so.
Yeah. Right. Let's take another caller here in Bloomington, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hello. Sarah, thank you. This is a wonderful program. I had a short story and a couple of questions. I lived in Tulsa for years. I'm from the Central Illinois here, and was really appalled to discover, white fountains and that sort of thing back in the 50s. Even there, which is really considered, part of the Midwest. But when I went overseas and when I came back in the early 60s, they had a bus boycott there. They were, on their way to integrating schools and everything, and they had a bus boycott. I remember that very distinctly, and the white people took part even in busing them in their cars, people to work. And I applauded that at the time. I was, it was a real struggle. But my question. I was wondering two things. There was that woman at the fountain, Alice, somebody, who made a stand at the fountain.
I'm not sure what you're talking about. Which fountain?
I don't know. There was, I'm sorry, but you don't hear much about her, but I think how brave that was for her. She went to the White Fountain, and I think it was her name was Alice something, and you just don't hear about that very much. But there were little, the way you were talking, it made me think there were little pockets all over.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And she was one, and I can't think about it. I just think how brave she was when I heard about it. And so you don't know anything about that. But
sorry, I just don't.
Yeah, the other question then was, I was acquainted with some Panthers there, and I wondered how much effect they had on this, you know, well, particularly your focus, but the movement in general. I certainly think they were brave individuals.
Definitely. You know, the Panthers, I mean, you bring up a good, touchy topic about Black Panthers. I mean, Black Panthers had some funky gender politics, to be perfectly frank. And, it was more of a masculine organization and an organization that promoted machismo. And there were lots of Black women who were sort of sent to the kitchen in many ways in a lot of Panther chapters. But there were lots of Black women who were also leaders of the Panthers and who did incredible organizing with the Black Panther movement. But, you know, as an issue, the Panthers did not really organize around the defense of Black women, except in the same ways that white men had traditionally organized around the defense of white women, that is to say, Black women are our women, and you, white man, can't touch them. It was a very gendered way to approach the topic, and an approach that a lot of Black women took issue with.
And I think maybe the worth underscoring the point about the fact that the movement, while certain people get a lot of attention,
right,
that this was a movement that was really carried out by a lot of folks whose names have not come down through history. Their names aren't recorded, but a lot of folks who at great risk to themselves took very courageous positions and just really everyday people who are not famous, and there are no statues to them, but without that, the aims of the movement never would have been accomplished.
Absolutely. That's so true. I mean, Ella Baker, you know, perhaps one of the most important women in the 20th century, certainly one of the most important political activists of the 20th century, said, Martin didn't make the movement. The movement made Martin. And that's so true. I mean, without the bus boycott, we may never have been introduced to this incredible 26-year-old preacher who went on to international prominence and helped to change the world. You know, it was because of the women in Montgomery who said no more that we got to meet Martin Luther King.
And one other thing that I was really struck by, and it was a little piece that you wrote basically about what your book is about, and I think I read it on the Huffington Post, where you said that after having done some of this research, that you felt like you had discovered a whole new civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
One wonders why it is that scholars and historians, people who've written about the movement, seem to have shied away from this topic. And I don't know if it's because it's just not something that's comfortable to deal with, or there were some other reasons why it hasn't maybe gotten the attention that it should?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think that you hit on a point pretty well, is that we have our own silences and we have our own discomfort with sexual violence in particular. So I remember hearing Taylor Branch talk at Columbia University one year after his third book in the King Trilogy came out. And he had mentioned something about Birmingham sexual violence. And after the talk, I spoke to him and I said, you know, what do you know? I'm studying this. Did you read about this? And he said, oh, it happened all the time. And I thought to myself, although I didn't have the courage to say it to him, why didn't you write about it in your book? Didn't you see the connection? And I think that oftentimes historians saw these things happening but really didn't see a larger connection to the movement because they limited the movement to civil rights, that is, voter registration, access to public accommodation, school desegregation, right? I mean, very limited campaigns and activities and didn't see sort of a larger movement that encompassed all of human rights and human dignity, something that activists, black activists in the 1940s, did. So that's part of it. But I also think we just tend to focus on these kind of heroic stories and, you know, national leaders and national campaigns like King and Medgar Evers and Rosa Parks and SCLC and the NAACP. And it's harder, I think, for people to go deeper than that. And historians have certainly done an incredible job chronicling the movement, especially local stories and local studies, and we're getting more and more women's stories from the movement. So I just think this is part of the process of peeling back the layers and trying to figure out what happened.
Well, I think that you make a really important point that that you can, you know, you can talk about all sorts of things, but you'd have to acknowledge just how vital the idea of security in your person is, that you should be able to walk down the street without being assaulted. At the same time, it's somehow harder to get a hold of,
right,
than something like the right to vote.
Exactly. I mean, what does it mean? What does it mean to be able to walk down the street and have freedom? What does that mean? And for many black women in the 1950s and 1960s, it meant being able to walk down the street without being assaulted, without being touched inappropriately, without being kidnapped, without being abducted and then gang raped. I mean, these are things we take for granted, and or most of us take for granted that we can do this in our world. But freedom is meaningless unless you have that personal security.
Well, there we'll have to leave it. We're here at the end of the time. Our guest, Danielle McGuire, she is assistant professor in the history department at Wayne State University, and her book is At the Dark End of the Street, Black Women, Rape, and Resistance, A New History of the Civil Rights Movement from Rosa Parks to the Rise of Black Power. Knopf is the publisher. And Professor McGuire, thank you very much for talking with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local production, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, is available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
Support comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held on Saturdays from 2 to 6 p.m. in the Bouvon Wine Bar. More information is available at thecorkscrew.com. Support comes from Subaru of Champaign County, located on Route 45 in Savoy. Dedicated to preserving our planet, the Subaru Assembly Plant in Lafayette, Indiana, achieved zero landfill status, with nothing from its manufacturing efforts going into a landfill. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. SubaruofChampaign.com or 352-4700.
It's 2 minutes before noon. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana. You'll find us online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Celeste Quinn. Jason Croft is our technical director. Let's take a look at commodity prices in Kansas City. May wheat trading at 831 and three quarters, down 13 and a quarter. July, 842 and three quarters, down 13. In Chicago, May wheat, 714 and a quarter, down 8. July, 750, down 7 and three quarters. September, 789, down 7 and a half. December, 817 and three quarters, down 7 and three quarters. May corn, 685 and a quarter, down 1 and a half. July, 692. 2.5 down 1.5. September, 647, up 1.25. December, 611 and 3 quarters, down 1.5. May soybeans are currently at 1360.5, down 5. July, 1370.25, down 4.75. August, 1367, down 3.5. September, 1352.5, down 4. May soybean meal down $2 at $364.40. May oil $55.72, down 14. April live cattle $113.72.5, down 55. June $112.75, down 110. March feeder cattle $129.15, down 85. April $131.30, down 10. April lean hogs $90.10. That contract is up 40 cents. May crude $106.08, up 1.11. The Dow is currently up 25 at 12,044. I don't have the U.S. dollar or the CRB index for you. The S&P 500 is down a point at 1293, and the NASDAQ is up a point at 2685. At noon Central Time, 66 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. The sky